as COP26 draws to a close, we've heard a lot about curbing emissions, about cutting out the private planes and the revolution in green energy. But that's not going to be enough if we're going to reverse the heating of the planet that's already underway. We're also going to have to grab some of that CO2 from the atmosphere and stick it somewhere safe. It's not often that something which is a cause of global warming can be flipped into a cure, but agriculture offers us a chance to do just that. Right now, land use, in terms of farming and forestry, contributes almost a quarter of global greenhouse gas emissions. Lots and lots of problems, and difficult ones to face because this is the stuff that feeds us. You know, we can't just rewild everything, but farming might also offer a solution. We've teamed up with the Nordic Council of Ministers for five more special editions of the Foreign Desk Explainer, part of an occasional ongoing series delving deep into topics of global importance from the region. This series is focusing on sustainability issues in the run-up to and during COP26 in Glasgow. We'll be looking at things like how the Nordic countries are trying to eat more sustainably, decarbonise industry, prepare for the consequences of climate change, and the subject of this episode, sustainable agriculture. Does livestock have a future in green farming? Should we plant quick-growing trees to capture carbon at the expense of biodiversity? And what about one of our most precious but overlooked and exploited resources, soil? Could it really be the solution to all our problems?
We're seeing that what if a farmer is a hero, you know, in solving the climate crisis?
Plants need calcium. Calcium comes from dead animals. We need animals in our farm. We need the fertilizer.
Now we walk into something different.
Oh my God, the contrast is amazing.
It's a bit darker, isn't it?
That was reporter Richard Orange deep in the forests of Sweden. We'll hear from him later in the programme. My name is Michael Booth. I'm Monocle's man in Denmark and the author of a book about the Nordic region, The Almost Nearly Perfect People. For this special edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers, we're going to take a look at agriculture. The Nordics have often been global leaders when it comes to green energy and transport. But how do they score when it comes to forestry and farming? Denmark has a long tradition of industrial agriculture, most famously pig farming, but the pig industry here is one of the reasons why the country still has one of the largest per capita CO2 footprints in the world. Professor Afton Halloran is a Canadian who's lived in Denmark for many years, and she's an expert in the green transition of food systems in the Nordics. I met up with her in Copenhagen to hear about the Danes' attempts at transitioning towards sustainable agriculture.
I think that what we've seen is, like, in society, values are changing, and at sometimes a quicker pace than industry has changed. And what we see initially is a bit of greenwashing, where there are some shortcuts that can be made. For example, you know, saying that CO2 emissions have been reduced from different companies in the food sector because they changed their farming practices, but because they maybe got electrical vehicles to transport their goods. But really what needs to change is actually when it comes to primary production. And we live in a country which is one of the largest producers of pork in the world. And we see a movement here where some people would like to eat less red meat. But at the same time, we also see export to China of these products because that's a market where people are going to buy. So there's still the production, but it's perhaps being displaced to another population. So that's not really going to solve the problem. Indeed, the efficiency of production is much higher compared to other parts of the world. So, you know, what the kilo of meat that you can get in terms of also the inputs that you give to it, give to your pig, your water, your feed, is much better than in other places in the world. But at the same time, that's only looking at, you know, at one kind of parameter to measure this. There are also, when you think about the emissions from those, and we're talking about millions of animals, we're also thinking about looking at the manure and where that needs to be applied. Then we have to also largen our way of evaluating these kinds of systems, not just in efficiency, but also in terms of other impacts that are both here on this soil, but also in other places in the world. So I think we're caught up in trying to become much better at a system that has developed over the last century or so that we've gotten so good at, but we haven't put the same resources into understanding, okay, what's next? How do we transition away from this? Right now, what we're going to aspire towards is not clear. So we still pride ourselves in the production of livestock, which has a role in food systems, but not to the degree that it does now. I mean, right now we're experiencing a highly industrialized system where also livestock aren't integrated into crop production. Nutrient cycling is not necessarily happening to the same degree that you would see in small-scale production. So
it's kind of the opposite of regenerative farming that happens in Denmark, wouldn't you say?
This has just been part of a historical movement, isolating animals and crops from each other and having kind of a non-circular model within our farming systems. So we have to be careful when we say that, okay, it's not the future that we want. It's actually the system. We have to understand what kind of production systems do we want to value. And what kind of systems are we going to say, no, this is enough. We can't continue to produce in this way because basically we know that it's contributing to climate change, to biodiversity loss. You know, if you go in the countryside in Denmark or the pig farms, you don't really see them. But the outsourced impacts of that production, it's massive. We're talking about, you know, in South America, deforestation.
The imported feed in particular.
We're talking about, you know, water resources. So we also have to understand, like, where those impacts are. Not only when it comes to, I mean, we point our finger at pigs, but it's also with other kinds of production, too. So we could think that we're quite clean here, but we are leaving a big footprint in other parts of the world.
That was Professor Aften Halloran talking to me in Copenhagen. I mentioned regenerative farming during that discussion without really explaining what it is. To get a better idea, I got in touch with Sara Kankan-Rinter, chair of the Carbon Action Platform, which develops and researches ways to capture carbon in soil. She has a fast-growing network of Finnish farmers who are learning about regenerative farming, why it's not just good for the environment, but good for their crops. You know, discussions about carbon capture often sound terribly high-tech, but it needn't be. The best carbon capture system we have are plants and the soil they grow in, as Sara explained.
To mitigate climate change, we need to, of course, curb emissions, that's for sure. But that's not enough, so we need to remove the carbon from the atmosphere. And the only known technique to remove carbon in a large scale is the nature. That is stated everywhere. So photosynthesis removes carbon dioxide naturally. Trees and plants, they remove carbon from the air and store it to the soil if the soil is in good condition. So soil has enormous potential. And then soil also has 25% of all the biodiversity on Earth. So this is just to say that we need to manage the climate crisis and biodiversity crisis together. And those who have the land have the power either to try to do that or not. Of course, it's not easy. Changing something is not easy for anyone. But in a way, farmers do know the principles of how to work with nature. They know what it means if you have more carbon in the soil because it's productivity for them. And our farmers have really noticed this, that actually when you start to make things differently, you make better crops.
And how many farmers do you have in your network at the moment? And what changes have they made?
About 100 intensively trained farmers. And then we have, because we didn't want to say no to farmers who wanted to join, but we can't intensively train everyone. So we made a Carbon Action Club, which has now over 700 farmers. And we did an e-learning course. We launched it a year ago, and we're hoping to get 10,000 partners for that.
Is that within Finland, 10,000? No.
Yeah, we hope to get it 10,000 in Finland, because that would be quite an amount of Finnish farmers.
How many farmers are there in Finland, Sara?
50,000 farms.
Wow.
Yeah, so we would be... Then you can actually say that you have a paradigm shift ongoing.
And what are the farmers doing under the program? What are you teaching them?
Like a typical case is that you have to use soil amendments because maybe the soil is poor and you need to get a kickstart for the life in soil. So you use maybe wood-based soil amendments or biochar or compost, somehow get the life going there. Then you have to have a diversity in your farming. So not just one cash crop and that's it, but you need to have diversity because diversity brings power. And then you need to have continuous cover crop. So as little as possible of bare soil, but then also between the years, not every year in the same way, but you have to have the crop rotation between the years. Everything I've said, it's not so new to the farmer, but maybe the new thing is that you start to look at your main resource in a different way. And then also one part of the regenerative agriculture is animals. And if you do the grazing in a holistic way, that's actually maybe one of the fastest ways to increase the carbon in the soil and biodiversity in the farm, which is a little bit controversial to the discussion now in society that what should we do. So for me, animal is not about me. For me, meat, it's about animal has its place in the ecosystem if you do it right.
Can you just define that term holistic farming for us?
Then the holistic grazing would be that you actually mimic the nature. So you mimic a little bit like it would be wild animals, that they stay on a piece of land just for a little while and then next day they change and next day they change. So nothing is over-pasteurized. So it actually accelerates the growing of the grass.
And in terms of the consumer in the supermarket, if all of your 50,000 farmers adapted to your recommendations, would things be more expensive in Finnish supermarkets?
There's a lot of discussion about what is the fair portion of retail and then the farmer's portion. I think it should be actually, as we all know, everything that it's not done in a regenerative way should be more expensive because that's actually what is costly for the society. But for what it's needed is that we should focus the heavy subsidies that we have here, the Common Agricultural Policy, towards this kind of farming. So then it wouldn't be. I do think that farmers who do the right things and farmers who really try to do everything they can for the nature and, of course, good quality food, they should be rewarded. And we have also a lot of food companies who have started to reward the farmers who actually go towards this regenerative way. And we do have retailers, one retail company at the moment, who is financing our research about soil carbon sequestration. I think that we believe that food can be produced, you know, while respecting the ecosystem and farmers making their living. That's the point, right? We're seeing that what if a farmer is a hero, you know, in solving the climate crisis. I think we still haven't unleashed the full potential of the soil. But this community keeps growing and I see the changes around the corner.
That was Sara Kankanrinta of Carbon Action, a Finnish organisation which was nominated for this year's Nordic Council Environment Prize. Incidentally, the prize was won by the think tank Concito for their climate database, which we featured in a previous programme. Staying in Finland, our correspondent there, Petri Bertsov, met up with the outgoing Environment Minister, Krista Mikkonen. She's been heartened by the shift from many of her country's farmers to a more sustainable form of farming, but acknowledges there's still a way to go. In fact, overall emissions from the sector aren't reducing at all, partly because of Finland's pressing problem with peat, a hot topic right now.
Even though we have many active farmers doing the climate action, if you look at the sector as a whole, the emission hasn't been decreased since the late 1990s. And that's a shame because those good work, what some of the farmers are doing, it doesn't show for the whole sector because at the same time, the main reason is that there's clearing for new fields, especially on peatlands. And from the peatlands, there's a lot of emissions. The sector as a whole, the emission has been the same for a long, long time, even though there have been many active farmers. And now we should make make sure that we can reduce the emissions for the whole sector. And one key thing is that we should stop the clearing new land for the fields, because most of the time it's also deforestation. So it's like a double harmful, because then you got the forests, which are the carbon sinks and carbon storage, and then at the same time you are having a new fields, especially on peatlands, which are a big emission.
Why is peat such a key issue here?
The peat is, for many reasons, problematic. Of course, when you dig out the peat, it's very harmful for the nature and the biodiversity, and it's also a big source of the carbon emissions. And in Finland, we still use peat for energy, even though now the amount is only about 5%. If you look at the emissions, it's over 10% for the whole carbon emissions of Finland. So the first thing is that we should get rid of the use of the peat for energy. But then the peatlands are also problematic. When you are farming on the peatlands, and especially when the field is open, then there's a lot of emission coming from the ground. So luckily there is a good farming techniques that you can avoid the emissions or make them smaller. So for example, one thing is that you should have this kind of wetland or pelud farming. And then the one thing is that you should make sure that there's a vegetation cover a year round, that helps to reduce the emissions. But because Finland is a land of the peat, so it's in many parts of the country, there's only peatlands available. So it's not so easy, but the main thing is that we should avoid clearing new peatlands for fields, because at the moment, it is only 10% of the peatlands for agriculture, and they cause more than half of the whole all emissions for agriculture.
Could you name some other examples of what needs to change in the Finnish agriculture sector in order for it to become more climate friendly?
I think the most important thing is that we could stop deforestation and clearing land for new fields. That's the biggest thing. Our field market doesn't work very well, so it's quite hard to buy or rent fields. So we need to do something for that, because at the moment we even have fields which are not in use, but there's at the same time in the same area there might be farmers who need more fields, but it's difficult to them to rent, buy new fields, even though there's at the same time fields which are not in use. And then we have this so-called carbon farming, that technique that actively capture carbon in ground, and that helps storage and being like as a sink, and it's also good for the ground, so you get better yields, and also the land is more resilient for different hot periods or dry periods.
That was Krista Mikkonen, Finland's outgoing environment minister, talking to our Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsoff. I'm aboard the wonderful electric ferry from Helsingør in Denmark to Helsingborg in Sweden. You can hear all about the ferry in a previous program. Today I'm on my way to rural Sweden to a farm-to-table restaurant, Stillsands. I thought it was time to find out more about regenerative farming, how it works in practice. Can regenerative farming save the world? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Hi. Flemming Schjøtt Hansen, and we are at Stedsands in Bohult, which is the eastern part of Halland. We have a restaurant, we have 16 cabins out in the forest, and then we have a farm where we provide most of the veggies for our guests. It's actually an experiment in how can we live with nature, where we reconnect with nature, where we close our own circles, we bring nutrition from the soil to the restaurant, to the compost toilets, back to the soil again, so we close our own loops.
Do you have any livestock?
We have chickens and we have bees.
Bees.
So we have a lot, actually.
Head count's quite high.
Exactly. We did have pigs the first year, 15 pigs of an old breed.
And tell me, how does that fit into a regenerative farm system, having livestock?
There's always been big grass eaters in nature. You know, if they're outdoor drinking rainwater or water from a pond, they pee it out again. They are water neutral. And the thing is, if you keep them in a rotation system, you can have your cows in one place for a day, put them into the next fence the next day, into the next fence the next day, and so on and so forth. And what they do is they eat down the grass, they fertilize, and they head on. And then the grass can grow up again. It builds up topsoil. It catches carbon in the soil, and it's water neutral. It's very sustainable. Plants need calcium. Calcium comes from dead animals. We need animals in our farm. We need the fertilizer. So when you go on that, plant-based or non-plant-based, it's against our nature. That's one of the things. Another thing is that nature needs animals to provide fertilizer and calcium. So if you want to think holistically, think animals into your farming. We need to live a balanced life with respect for plants, animals, fungi, humans, everyone. The biggest challenge is that it's a new thing. It's untested. It's a lot of trial and error. And of course, having a lot of different stuff means that you'll need to know a lot about a lot of veggies and herbs and stuff like that. So of course it is a process. Conventional farming, you can just go to farming school, learn how to do, which machines to buy, and it's rolling. There's a system up and rolling for it. Here we're treading new waters. If you have a healthy soil, the rest is easy. You don't plow, you leave the soil bare. That means that the sun cannot dry the soil out, and you have a covering layer that creates life.
So we're standing by a large pile of sawdust.
And cow manure.
Organic matter.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. That's the nitrogen. That will compost and become beautiful topsoil.
Mm. Is this for real? Is this serious, Fleming? Can it feed the world?
The only way to feed a growing population is small-scale organic farming. And even though all political and economical structures support big-scale farming, you have no access to the supermarkets unless you can provide 10,000 tons of potatoes every day. Still more food is being produced small scale today.
And actually, one thing I've noticed since stepping into your garden, there are insects everywhere.
There's a lot of life here. Another thing that is really fun is we don't have these, what are they called, Siberian murder slugs, or what are they called? These are red slugs that are in everybody's garden.
Yeah, exactly. Drabosnell, killer slugs.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't have them here. They are in the surrounding villages, but they're not here. So again, biodiversity helps fighting invasive species. This system provides 30 cubic meters of compost every year, free food. And another thing it does is that it provides us with 30 cubic meters of hot mass inside an insulated greenhouse. So free food, happy healthy chickens, heat for our greenhouses, and compost for our gardens.
That was Fleming Schulte-Hansen of Stillsense in southern Sweden, putting soil carbon capture theories to the test. So we've heard about a paradigm shift, which might be around the corner in Nordic farming, but there's another area of land use which tends to get much less coverage in the media: forestry. In Finland and Sweden, forestry is a significant part of the national agriculture, but there's a big discussion going on about how Sweden manages its forests. It's complicated. The more trees they grow, the more carbon is captured, which is good. But there's a price to pay in terms of biodiversity. Richard Orange went along to find out more from a rather evangelical Swedish forester.
Look around, Richard, and see with your eyes how inviting this forest is. Like for the eye, the variety of species, you have the variety in size and in height and everything.
Magnus Bondesen from the Swedish Forestry Agency has taken me to this pine forest in southern Sweden to show me how plants, birds and animals flourish when forests are not harvested in huge football pitch sized clearances. Clear cutting, where every tree in a plot is cut down at the same time, is the way 97% of commercial forests are managed in Sweden. And Bondesen has taken me to meet a forest owner who, like him, is an evangelist for the lower impact alternative, continuous cover forestry.
Lars Erik Levin, we are in Lilla Tronghyltan.
This is continuous cover, is it?
Yeah, if you look to your left here, mm-hmm. This is harvested in 2017. He took down 70 cubic meters per hectare. He harvested in 2017.
And how does that compare to how much you'd take per hectare if you were clear cutting?
They took 300 cubic meters per hectare, and here he took about 70. And you see here, new plants coming? mountain ash, birch, spruce, and here the roebuck has scraped the antlers in the
tree.
Oh, there's even a pine.
Yeah. Pine.
If you start to look close, there's plants all over the place.
Oh, kungsfågel, Hervey.
Yeah.
Kungsfågel.
It's a goldcrest. When Lars Erik started managing this plot as continuous cover in the 1980s, he told no one. The practice was borderline criminal, with forest owners caught doing it sent stern letters. Now things are very different. The EU's new forest policy, published in July, says clear-cutting should be approached with caution. Sweden's Green Party wants continuous cover increased from 3% of forests to 30%. For Lars Erik, nature protection is only part of the appeal.
Why did you keep this area continuous cover, like in the 80s?
Beautiful, and they produce money.
But you think you can get more money from here than with a...
I think so.
But for all Lars Erik's enthusiasm for continuous cover, less than 10% of his forest is managed that way. Part of the reason Bundesen has taken me here is to show me that the environmental case against clear-cuts is far from obvious. In a few steps, we are in a plantation of spruce, where every tree is 30 years old, and each lined up in evenly spaced rows.
Now we walk into something different.
Oh my God, the contrast is amazing.
It's a bit darker, isn't it?
But here, this produces 15 to 20 cubic meters per hectare a year. And that produces 5.
Wow.
Do you understand the climate impact here? What this binds in carbon dioxide?
And how is the biodiversity different here?
Well, it's zero here. It doesn't feed a mouse in here.
The European Union was saying that Swedish forestry is not ecologically sustainable and that there should be a no clear cut, really, or as little as possible. I mean, what do you say to that?
I think they need to come to Lilla Trånghultan and to meet Lars Erik and see what it's all about.
But why is that? Would that be worse for the climate?
Well, the forestry has not created the climate problem, but we are part of the solution. Like, we can bind carbon dioxide, but we can very efficient substitute many different things that are worse for the climate. But we also have to work with the biodiversity. And we do that when we make a clear cut. We don't make the whole thing just clear. We save some, we take precautions, we get better at it.
You see, he has saved a wet area.
He has only harvested some spruce in there, but left the rest. He's saved some pines in the edges. There's an oak down there, there's a mountain ash, there are a few stumps, and over there you see the lower stumps up there. Mm-hmm.
So it's not that very clear.
But if I was coming here, and just as a conservationist, I come here, I look at this, and you know, you can just see...
Devastation.
It's devastation. Yeah, the forests have all taken away. How can this possibly not be terrible for the environment?
Well, it's not a good thing for the biodiversity. It's not, but it's something that we have to do to feed us, so to say, and also to, maybe for the climate change, that we need to use the forestry products. Here we will have a very good spruce standing in the future that will bind a lot of carbon dioxide.
But you say, you know, that this will bind a lot of carbon, but that will be in, what, 60 years? And by that time, we'll have passed all of our climate change, global warming thresholds.
Yeah, but we have used the wood as well for substitution for oil and gas, coal and like that. And maybe we make clothes of it to save from the cotton industry. And we make energy, heating the houses and making electricity. And it's not in 60 years that we will bind. We saw the standing before, it was 30 years old. And it was growing almost 20 cubic meters per hectare and year. Binding a lot. You have to see the whole circle. You can't just look at one clear cut. You have to look at, for example, the Lilla Trånghultan, the estate here. He has a 2-hectare clear cut, but then he has 98 hectares of growing forest, binding carbon dioxide, and doing a lot for the biodiversity. So we have to have both and. The picture is not so simple.
It seems the debate about clear cutting is not clear cut at all.
Richard Orange in Lilla Trånghulten, southern Sweden, for Monocle.
That's all for this week's special episode of the Foreign Desk Explainer. Listen out for more of these editions produced by me, Michael Booth, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers. It was edited by the Monocle 24 team in London. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.